Welcome back to Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, and inspired by the State of Diversity Environmental Organizations report, written by Dr. Dorcita Taylor from the University of Michigan, and also written about by Whitney Pipkin in the Bay Journal. We're here with both of them and Fred Tupman, who is the Patuxent Waterkeeper, and Jacqueline Patterson, who's director of the NAACP Climate Justice Initiative. And you all at 410-319-8888. If you're an environmental activist listening to this program, if you're not, join us. How you think this can be dealt with? Or you can write to us at talk@steinershow.org, tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. We'd love to hear your thoughts and ideas on this. But so we're at positive the end. So if we take it from the perspective of where we are, where this show is being broadcast from, how, and you're talking about the runoff from the farms that are polluting the bay and all the other runoff from people's homes and the rain tax and all the other madness people are debating, how does that change? How does both the message change and the heart of the fundamental of what the movement is about change?
Well, I think you'd have a fight on your hands if you tried to change the messaging of the Bay Movement in particular. The Bay Movement is a nature-loving movement, first and foremost. And for many people who are connected to it, their whole perspective is that the Bay is the center of the ecosystem that they care about. So they only care about smart growth in so much as it affects the Bay. Pesticides in so much as it affects the Bay. Anything is only in so much as it affects and drains to the Chesapeake Bay, which does not resonate to people who don't have that same kind of connection to the Bay. Doesn't deal with toxics, doesn't deal with food deserts, doesn't deal with any number of things. Any gathering of African-American environmentalists that I've ever been to, the bandwidth for talking about the environment as a interconnected ecosystem is far broader than the Bay Movement, which is a regional movement that follows a particular leadership and a particular set of traditions and a particular set of funders. So in that sense, you know, you use the phosphorus management tool. Well, yeah, it's a huge ecosystem issue, but it's not one that resonates particularly well in communities that are hardest hit by toxic hazards from the environment. Right, it's not a public health movement, right? It's a save the crab, crabs, the oysters, the turtles, the living resources of the bay. It distinguishes itself, again, from social justice, which is completely enmeshed with virtually any environmental problem you're likely to find in a community of color. Period. End of story.
And Dorcita, in some ways, even though you're based in Michigan, not here, but you have a national view of this. This is what your new book is about, in some ways.
Yes, the Toxic Communities book really shows the extent to which all of these issues are very interconnected, in which, you know, the social, the economic, the political. It also talks about how African-American leaders from the 1960s was really pushing to link these issues together and was ignored in a way by the predominantly white environmental movement, but also in communities of color. And since we are talking about the Bay, my book coming out next year with Duke University, which is called Power, Privilege, and the Rise of the Conservation Movement, one of the things I do in that book is to really show how even us as black people, we don't promote our contributions to the environment very much. So if we look at Harriet Tubman, for instance, who was a slave born and raised in the Bay, she's often portrayed in most environment and black literature as, you know, the conductor on the Underground Railroad. I often say to my students, if you were Harriet Tubman and you had to be a runaway slave, you had to understand ecology and you had to exploit it to accomplish what she did. And she was by far, in my mind and in my book, I frame her as one of the leading environmentalists of the 19th century.
Wow.
If you look at what she had to do, how much knowledge she had to have, how she learned from the system, utilized it, turned it on its head to free over 300 slaves. So part of what we also have to do as black thinkers, intellectuals, and activists is to make these communities relevant to kids. Because the same black students are ready to walk out my classes when I start talking about environment. The minute I start in on Harriet Tubman, I start to talk about York, the slave that Lewis and Clark, without Sacagawea and York, could not have made it across the country. And the number of black explorers that went to the West, opened up cities like Los Angeles. Half of the people who founded Los Angeles were African Americans. We once owned Hollywood. So So we need to bring those kinds of histories, because white kids are embedded in the environmental movement because they see their history reflected in it. We have not done that yet for African Americans and their contributions to the environmental movement. At one point, the U.S. Army in 1865, they used Harriet Tubman as a minesweeper because she understood the ecology of the Chesapeake Bay so well that she could detect any mines that the Southern Army had laid down.
That I never heard before. That's interesting. Wow.
Not a single ship got blown up as she was able to bring them into the mines. This was a slave. She grew up in those wetlands, collecting muskrats, collecting edible foods and weeds and that sort of stuff. We need to bring that, just like we're doing with urban agriculture, to have black kids understand the idea of food sovereignty, food control, and doing this through how you engage food in urban areas. We need to do the same thing, reclaim the bay, reclaim that history. The history of whaling. At one point, most of the whalers, a lot of them were African-American whalers.
Right.
And we haven't done very well. So if our kids can connect that and understand what Tubman did in the 1860s and 50s, they will understand that we can now say we don't want pollution in our communities, take on the big powers and organize movements to heal our community.
Well, what you said is just really profound as well. I'm dying now for that book to be published. We can get you back now just to talk about the book.
it should be out next year, because what it does is basically it really gets at this idea that the environment is all about white Europeans coming in and settling it and creating stuff from scratch. No, slave owners didn't know how to plant rice. They deliberately went to Africa, chose slaves that had experience and skill in growing rice. The slaves brought the cultivars with them and developed the rice plantations on the Gullah Island. So we weren't just dumb slaves running around the plantation waiting for somebody to give us some work to do. And if we think about it, British noblemen, what do they know about growing rice and cotton and this stuff? Yeah. No, they don't. So
Jack,
we have to turn it on its head for our kids to understand their legacy and to say, yeah, we got this, you know?
I love this. Jackie, you were trying to say what? Is that you?
Oh, and Mark, we have a story in the next issue about that would be along these lines.
Whitney.
Interesting.
Sorry.
That my colleague wrote. Yeah, this is Whitney. About the community of Highland Beach south of Annapolis. And there's a black mayor there that's turning around the town and making it a paragon of great infrastructure. And this is in the place where Frederick Douglass built his summer house
right.
that he never quite got to live in. But and then in Annapolis, you have a Black Maritime Museum. So there are these threads throughout the watershed. And some of the environmental justice movements, there's now a coalition operating in the DMV area, largely thanks to Dr. Sacoby Wilson of the University of Maryland. They've been putting together, there was a conference this past weekend, of the EJ movement in the Chesapeake watershed, and they're beginning to weave those things together, but it's sort of coming from two different directions, like Fred talked about, and it'll be interesting to see how folks like him and some of the people working on the ground can make the Chesapeake Bay an issue that resonates with more diverse communities.
So I'm curious, let me turn to Fred and to Jackie here and just talk about as the two of you who are your daily lives are active in the environmental movement. That's what you do for a living, the both of you, right? So how do we take this? We don't have much time to do this in this segment, but we can continue this conversation in many ways over the coming weeks and months. But how does that transformation begin to take place, do you think, Fred?
I actually think, first of all, that we have to, again, completely ping at reorienting the focus of the regional movement. In my case, that's the Bay Movement, which largely resents these views. I've been saying this stuff for 30 years. Nobody really wants to hear it, and in fact, I even had folks tell me that it's disingenuous. You know what some guy said to me? We let you in here.
We now, let you in here.
Yes, mm-hmm. And yet now you have the nerve to criticize. All I'm really saying, Lord, first of all, mercy, is that I serve all citizens in my watershed, all communities. I don't care what color they are. But I recognize that people have very different circumstances and different lenses based, as the author just said, on their cultural experiences. That is diversity, and diversity is beautiful. Diversity makes a more powerful movement, not a divided movement, not a weaker movement. So how are you going to say biodiversity in nature if you have a very non-diverse movement? It's shocking. It's a bizarre concept. Everyone tells me in the Bay Movement that we all want the same things, you know, because we all rely on air, water, and clear land and all that stuff. The truth is we don't all need the same things because of the circumstances we live in and the society we live in. Race matters. And the way we deal with this is we discuss it and we try to solve problems jointly. We don't pretend that everybody's the same because they're not, right? The mere fact that we're talking about trying to get diversity means obviously we're not the same, right? So that's how we do this, is we hit these problems square on the head and we go after them and we try and solve them. Not just kind of mince around them and say, well, let's just, you know, change the makeup of the workforce and maybe it'll happen naturally. Well, yeah, it will in 1,000 years, maybe, just maybe. That's not the way to get this done.
And Jackie, we don't have 1,000 years.
Pardon?
I said, and we don't have 1,000 years.
Yeah, we don't have 1,000. That's very true. Yeah. So, I agree with all that has already been said. And I would, and one of the things that we have been doing has been really helping to contextualize some of these environmental issues within what we're, with our kind of bedrock civil rights issues, and help, and also with that, helping environmental organizations to be able to see the linkages between our bedrock civil rights issues and the environmental issues that they're working on, so that they're not seeing environmental issues through such a narrow lens, and that we and our constituencies aren't looking at environmental issues as being the separate thing from what we deal with every day. So as an example, we've been able to forge partnerships with the Sierra Club, and they leaned in on the Ferguson situation and, you know, really put out a mailing to all of their membership to join the Ferguson march and rally that we were doing in Missouri, and really were, through shared conversations and analysis, we were able to really talk about the contextualizing the place-based inequalities and the political systems and how they lead to these disparities, whether it's in racial profiling and police brutality, or whether it's in where toxic facilities are placed. So we really have these great intersectional conversations that benefit both sides and helping to understand the systemic underpinnings of all of these different social justice issues, including environmental justice. So that's something that we're working on, and that has been really successful in moving both sides to really start to see this broader and deeper analysis and need for action.
Now, this is a kind of, to me, critically important what we're covering today, and I think that this for us is just the tip of the iceberg of exploring this very important subject and pushing it, and I think that we are in a unique position here in the Chesapeake Bay watershed area to really have an effect here on Sound Bites and the work we're doing to change that dynamic. And I think that the envelope has just barely been pushed on this show, and we're going to look forward to pushing this across the room and forcing the conversation around the state with our environmental partners. And making this a conversation that is at the heart of our continuing struggle. Now, first of all, I want to thank, I'm really happy that we found Dr. Dorcita Taylor and her work. I'm looking forward to Toxic Communities, a new book coming out, and this report we're going to be linking to the state of diversity in environmental organizations. Dr. Dorcita Taylor, thank you so much for joining us, and I look forward to our continuing conversation.
Thank you. It was a pleasure joining you and all the other guests.
Great to have you here. And Whitney Pipkin, thanks for putting this out in the Chesapeake Bay Journal, the Bay Journal, and your keen interest in making this part of our conversation. Look forward to working with you again in the coming weeks and months.
Great. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Whitney Pipkin. And I want to thank Jackie Patterson for taking her time out at this conference in Peru. She was in to join us by phone, director of the NAACP Climate Change Climate Justice Initiative. Jackie, look forward to seeing you back in Baltimore. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Take it easy.
You too. And Fred Tupman came in here, Patuxent Riverkeeper, who has been writing some amazing things. And I'm finally glad we got him in the studio. And you'll be hearing a lot more from him on Soundbites in the future. Fred, thank you so much for being here as well.
You bet.